Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the program today, we'll be talking with astronomer, science writer, David Levy. He is, among other things, one of the most successful comet discoverers ever. He has discovered 22 and perhaps is best known as the co-discoverer with Eugene and Carolyn Shoemaker of Shoemaker-Levy 9. You may remember that was the comet that collided with the planet Jupiter back in 1994. He is science editor for Parade magazine. He's contributing editor for Sky and Telescope magazine, where he writes its monthly Star Trails column. He has authored many books about astronomy. He won an Emmy in 1998 as part of the writing team for the Discovery Channel documentary 3 Minutes. He is president of the National Sharing the Sky Foundation. That's an organization that's intended to inspire people to develop an inquiring interest in the sciences. He was born in Canada. He now makes his home in Arizona, and he's here visiting the campus. He's going to give a talk. This is in the MillerCom series, and that's scheduled for tonight at 7:30. It takes place in the auditorium of the Beckman Institute, and he'll be talking about Shakespeare as a sky watcher, joining astronomy with English literature. And we're pleased that he could be here and spend a little time with us talking maybe about that and also some other things. So,
yeah, hi, David.
Hi. I'm really pleased that you could be here.
Yeah, delighted to be here. This should be a lot of fun.
Well, if people have questions, if they have general astronomy questions, they can call in, and he will do his best to give you an answer. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. So how and where and when did you become interested in astronomy?
It was actually very suddenly. I was a little eight-year-old, very homesick at a summer camp in Vermont. And I remember it was the 4th of July, 1956, and we were watching the 4th of July fireworks. And I was Canadian. I didn't know from Independence Day. I didn't know what that was all about. All I knew was that I wanted to go home so badly. And then after the fireworks was over, they sent our little cabin back early. The sky was just getting dark. And I remember walking up the field with my, there were three other campers and two counselors. And I looked up and saw a meteor. It wasn't even that bright a meteor. But ladies and gentlemen, that meteor called to me. It actually called. And I asked the others, did you see that shooting star? And they said, no, we didn't see anything. And then I thought, even more, that was just for me. It wasn't for a number of years before I finally got the bug of astronomy, but that's how it started.
Yeah, I'm impressed by more and more, if I have the opportunity to meet people or talk to them or hear about them, how many people became professional astronomers because when they were kids, they got jazzed about it at that age, and that kind of excitement for the sky and for looking at the sky just never went away.
It never went away, but it took a while before the seed germinated. It was several years. I remember there was I think the next thing was in 1957. I was walking home one October afternoon, and a friend of mine had told me that the Russians had launched a new moon into space called Sputnik. And I was wondering why my parents were so concerned about that. Mm-hmm. And then in 1959, October 2nd, there was an eclipse of the sun, a partial eclipse that I saw, the first of 77 eclipses that I've seen in the past now. And then in 1960, a cousin of mine gave me a book about the planets when I broke my arm after a bicycle accident. And that really did it. By then, that's all I wanted to do was be an astronomer. Yeah.
So, but you didn't go into astronomy as a career. Well, I suppose it is a career in a sense, but strictly speaking, you're not a professional astronomer.
No, I'm not. I'm an amateur astronomer. In fact, I hope this won't cost me my audience tonight, but I've never taken a course in astronomy. Everything that I've picked up about astronomy has been self-taught, and I've learned it myself from books, by making friends with some of the best astronomers I could find, and by looking through my telescope.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting to maybe we talk a little bit about the business of discovering comets. I mentioned the fact that you had discovered a number of them, and I know that a lot of them were literally from your backyard looking in your telescope. And that's one of the things that is really cool about astronomy, is that it is something that you can do. It's not terribly expensive. If you're lucky enough to be in a place where the sky's pretty dark, you can do that. And in fact, I think that most of the comets that we know about actually – now, maybe I'm going a step too far if I say most. A lot of the comets we know about were discovered by amateurs, in part because they have a lot of – they spend a lot of time just looking.
Actually, I believe that I had gone to 5 new comets before I had spent $1,000 on my hobby of astronomy. Mm-hmm. And since then, it's been more. Trying to keep up with it now is very expensive because the pros have taken over. It's partly my own fault because – I had something to do with the discovery of Comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 that collided with Jupiter. And in the wake of that, Congress asked my colleague Gene Shoemaker to chair a committee to get an operation going where comets could be found automatically and by camera. And that's how it's mostly done now.
Mm-hmm. And what number are we up to now in terms of not named comets, but apparently they have numbers, they have some kind of designation?
They have a very complicated designation system now because it used to be very simple. First comet of a year would be called A and the second one B, but that was too simple, so they made it more complicated. But comets still have names. If they're discovered by a person, it gets the name of the person. If they're discovered by a program, it often gets the name of a program. But comets are now being found a little bit more often than they were before, but mostly by spacecraft and by big funded programs.
Mm-hmm. What does it take to find a comet? Just spending a lot of time looking for something
that's moving?
It takes three
things, David. It takes three things.
Yeah.
It takes patience, takes a good knowledge of the sky, and a fairly wide field telescope that can show you a lot of the sky at once, and patience.
Uh-huh. Well, for most comets, I suppose that may have something to do with how far away they are. How fast do they move? And can you actually see them? Or is it a matter of you look one day and it's this point, and you look another day later and it's moved a little bit, and then you look a couple of more days later and then it's moved a little bit and you realize this thing is moving like that?
Usually you get to sense motion within an hour. So I remember one morning on October the 2nd, 2006, it was actually Yom Kippur morning, the holiest day in the Jewish calendar. I was out there observing, and I thought, I'm going to start at Saturn. And I turned the telescope just north of Saturn, started comet hunting. About 3 seconds later, Saturn went into the field with its beautiful moon Titan and a couple of other moons, and then a comet right next to it.
Mm-hmm.
And after 12 years, I just couldn't believe it. I was just blown away by that. And that's a comet that's periodic. It's coming back every 5 years. And when it comes back again at the end of 2011, it will pass very close to the Earth, not far from the moon, actually. Mm-hmm.
So I suppose also part of it is you have to be familiar enough with the sky to know that if there's something that doesn't belong there, you know what the other things are that you're seeing. And if there's something that you're seeing that you say, wait a minute, what is that? That's your tip-off?
It helps, David. It helps to have a sense of the sky. You don't have to know every last little star that's in there, but it helps to have a sense of it. And Leslie Peltier once wrote years ago, "For the dedicated watcher of the sky, each nightfall is a time fraught with suspense. Will the sky tonight be just the same as it was last night, or has something happened since then?"
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take a call here from someone, because I want to, if someone here who's been on hold for a little bit, and I try not to make people wait too long. And in fact, if you have questions you'd like to call in, talk with our guest, David Levy, the number here is in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have somebody up in the northern part of the state in Rockford. This is line number 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Good morning.
I was thinking about buying a pair of binoculars to get started in astronomy. I don't know anything about it, but something along the lines of maybe like a 15 by 70 power. But are there any good books specifically on binocular astronomy that I could pick up and learn from?
Well, there is. That's a very good question. Firstly, about the books, I have a book that I wrote a number of years ago called David Levy's Guide to the Night Sky, and that has a large section on what to do with just a pair of binoculars. The second thing about binoculars, that if you can afford a binoculars that have stabilizing on them, I know Canon makes a good pair. They're more expensive, but boy, they're worth it. You just point the binoculars to what you want to see, press a button, and it's as if you have them mounted on a firm tripod.
Really?
They're actually stabilized, and that, if you can afford them, that's what I would recommend.
Or maybe just a good tripod?
A good tripod would also be good. A binocular holder on a tripod would also be very good. If you're going to get a binoculars like 11 by 80s or something like that, where 80 is the size, the millimeter size of the lenses,
yes,
you're getting a little heavy to hold on. And all the stars you look at are going to look like fireflies unless they're mounted.
Yep. Do you think that would be like a good size binoculars to get to start off with?
I use a pair of 10 by 50s, which I find are perfect for astronomy.
Oh,
I think 50s are just fine for astronomy. They're also known as Navy night glasses.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for the call. Other questions are welcome to 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, you know, I'm glad to know about, I think probably people will be glad to know about the image stabilization, because the one problem with binoculars is if you're standing there and you're holding them, trying to hold them steady enough so that you don't get a lot of wobble in what it is you're looking at. That's maybe the one.
I think the stabilization binoculars are the best thing since sliced bread. They're great.
And I suppose if you do other things like you do bird watching or other sorts of things, that would be
good.
Oh,
they're fantastic. I brought them to a Cubs game, spring training. Just the Cubs do their spring training in Tucson.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife Wendy and I went to see them one day. And I was just focusing on the batter and pressing the button, and it was as if I was looking through a TV camera. The image was so steady and so beautiful. That's one of the major developments in optical technology in the last 10, 20 years, and I very strongly recommend it.
Mm-hmm. Let me just introduce quickly again our guest, David Levy. He is the science editor for Parade magazine. He's a contributing editor for Sky and Telescope. He's the author of a number of books about astronomy, has discovered a number of comets, and as I mentioned at the beginning, that maybe he is best known as the co-discoverer of Shoemaker-Levy 9, along with Eugene and Carolyn Shoemaker. That was, you remember, back in 1994. It collided with the planet Jupiter. Was fairly spectacular.
Yes.
Event and got a lot of attention, and questions are welcome here.
Do you remember in those days there was an article that came out, I think, in Science magazine called "Beware, the Great Fizzle is Coming," and so we were as surprised as anybody when Jupiter just turned black with all the spots from those impacts.
So the thing was that scientists didn't really know what would happen.
We hadn't a clue. We absolutely didn't have a clue as to what would happen during that week. It was so difficult to predict what was going to happen. The best thing to do was, Nature was putting on a demonstration, and she said, all you need to do is watch. Don't do anything. Don't launch a space probe. Just watch. And we did, and it was great.
Well, maybe you could tell the basic story, because I'm sure that there are some people who say, well, yeah, I vaguely remember that, but maybe don't have a really strong memory of what happened.
Well, we had thanks, David. We were in at Palomar Observatory that night, the three of us, a very cloudy, rainy, stormy, windy observing run, and we had photographic film to use to take pictures then. This was before the dawn of regular CCD imaging. And we had the telescope going, and we took one picture of a field of view right next to Jupiter, and then it clouded over again, and we had to wait over an hour before it cleared up and we could take the second picture. And then the next day was windy and cloudy, and Carolyn was scanning the two fields, first and second, and suddenly she stumbled on something that looked like, she said, a squashed comet. And she said, I don't know what I've got, but it looks like a squashed comet. And Gene ran over and took a look at it. And then he looked at me, a look of unbelievable bafflement. Mm-hmm. He had no idea what it was. And so I figured, I need to get a look at this. And I went over and I took a look. And you could see this line of fuzzy light with a bar on either end, extension on either end, and then about five or six tails going off. It was absolutely beautiful. The line was not moving in the direction of the line like a train, but it was moving perpendicular to where the line was, like linebackers running down a football field. It was the most unusual sight, cometary sight I'd ever seen. And I remember when we got a friend of ours to confirm it with a telescope in Arizona that night, I remember when I called him and I said, did we get anything? And he said, boy, did you ever. This is the strangest cometary form I've ever witnessed. And he said, just doesn't seem to end. Just goes on forever. And I said, thank you for checking it out for us. And he said, you don't understand, David. I'm going to spend the rest of the night on this comet. And it turned out he spent the rest of his observing week on this comet and much of the rest of the year on it.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about it was that special or that unusual?
What was unusual about this comet was that it had, within a few months of discovery, passed so close to Jupiter that Jupiter's tidal force yanked it apart and just pulled it apart into about 21 different pieces. And then in July of 1994, all 21 of those pieces slammed into Jupiter, traveling at about the rate of 140,000 miles an hour. At that speed, the comet could cross the United States in about a minute.
And how big were the pieces that we're talking about?
They ranged in size from, depending on whose theory you agree with, they ranged in size from about, a quarter of a mile to about a mile. But it very much depends on whose theory you abide by.
Mm-hmm. We have another caller here to talk with. Let's do that. Champagne, line number one. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping that you can help me identify a book that I came upon a number of years ago. I picked it up in a library and looked at it and thought it was very interesting, and I didn't have it. I thought at the time to take it out and read it, and I neglected to write it down. I thought I would remember. It possibly was a textbook. It was hardback, had a black matte cover, and the thing that distinguished it that makes it interesting is that instead of presenting an overview of what we know about astronomy, it started out and explained how people started with just the naked eye and how each progression, I guess it would be technological progression, how each thing led to the next that allowed us to learn the next thing, that allowed us to form the next question, that formed the next pursuit of the knowledge, and it just went all the way through. And I'd like to locate that book again.
Well, if this show were to run for about a week, I could go through the hundreds, maybe thousands of books that could have been. George Ebel, late of Palomar Observatory, wrote a very nice textbook that might fall into that category.
Mm-hmm.
Bart Bock wrote five editions of his book on the Milky Way, and all five of them could be in that category. But my recommendation is that if you get some time, that you return to that library or bookstore and take a look again and try to find the book a second time.
Okay.
There are a lot of good books about astronomy that have been written. My very favorite, a book that I've read that I would recommend to everyone, was written by a Midwesterner, by Leslie C. Peltier. It was called Starlight Nights, The Adventures of a Stargazer. It's his autobiography. And, you know, if I were on the Titanic and Captain Smith came and said, we're going down, In our library is a copy of every book written in the history of the world. You're all entitled to run in and grab one, but that's all you get. I would run in and grab a copy of Starlight Nights. That would be my book to go down with.
Okay, Starlight Night.
Starlight Nights.
By Peltier. By
Leslie Peltier. The Adventures of a Stargazer. It's still in print. You can get it published by Sky Publishing Corporation. I wrote the foreword of the latest edition to it, but my part of it isn't what you're getting the book for. It's Leslie. The reason that it's so good is that all the other books I know tell you how to go out and look at the night sky. This book tells you why you need to do that, and that's why I recommend it so highly.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks. And telephone number here, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. If people are lucky enough to live someplace or go someplace where there's a really dark sky, or even I think here, I have been told, I haven't done this, but I have been told that if you get far enough away, particularly I think that the direction you want to go is southeast of Champaign-Urbana, you don't have to go too far before the sky does indeed get dark, and you start to see, to experience the power of it. And I think you can start to try to get yourself in the frame of mind of our forebears, people who lived in time when there was no artificial light, so there was no light pollution, imagining how it must have felt to go out and look up and see a staggering, impossible to number amount of stars and things in the sky, and also to think about the fact that it's not static. Things are going on there and changing all the time, and it's not really surprising that you would attach great significance to that because it's such a powerful thing. It's not something you can ignore.
No, it's not. It's our birthright. I don't think there's a whole lot in this world that's more beautiful than the night sky, especially at the beginning of the night and when you're away from city lights. The bane of astronomy right now is light pollution. Our cities have grown so much that it's very difficult to find a sky that's dark where you can see the Milky Way and thousands of stars coming out in the night sky. I'm glad that you mentioned that you can do it here, and you don't have to go to southeastern Arizona to get the really darkest of the dark skies in our country, but to be able to just go a little bit away from town, or even in town, away from a city light, and watch the stars come out, it's a wonderful thing. Yeah. And I really do recommend it to all of our listeners today.
Yeah. It's a few weeks back, I had the chance to talk with Neil deGrasse Tyson, who is an astronomer and has written a lot about astronomy, and he's the guy who directs the planetarium in New York.
Yeah, I know Neil. I love the guy. We're always arguing about the status of Pluto.
And what was funny is that he, in a recent book, he tells a story about how when he was a kid, he grew up in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And his first visit to that planetarium that he now directs, he said he was sitting there and the lights came down and the stars came out in the planetarium. And he said, "Hey, wait a minute. What are you trying to pull here? This is not the sky. I know what the sky looks like. It doesn't look like this." Well, if you grow up in Brooklyn, no, it doesn't look like that. That was the way it would look like if you were, you know, at the Grand Canyon or something like that, where there wasn't a lot of lights. And it just it made me think about what everything that we miss if you live in, particularly if you live in a big city where there's lots of artificial light at night.
Yeah. The International Dark Sky Association was founded strictly to try to preserve the night sky. And I strongly recommend that you pay attention to that, the idea of dimming lights a little bit, not so much making the lights faint, but directing the glow downwards. Did you know that this country spends about $1 million a year to light up the underbellies of birds and airplanes? It's light that's utterly wasted, thrown into the night sky, has no value whatsoever. And so just by where you send the light would be a great way to help darken our sky a little bit and let people find the magic of what's up there. It's a wonderful thing just to go out and look at the night sky. At the end of April, there will be a meteor shower. If you can stay up till midnight or so, around April 24th or so, you'll be able to look and see some meteors coming out of the constellation of Lyra. And that's something I would recommend, and something that I think is very worthwhile, very worthwhile doing. That's how I got started, is by looking at meteors. The beautiful thing about looking at meteors is that you don't need a telescope. You can get into it and not pay a penny to enjoy astronomy. Most people feel now you have to go out and buy these big devices that you point at the sky and it tells you where you're looking at. Well, actually, I've tried them, and I find it's a lot easier. The best thing to do is to get something called a planisphere. It costs a few dollars. I know that there's one that you can get for only $2 or $3. Another that they don't cost more than 20 at the most. And it's a star wheel, and you set it for the time and date, and it tells you every star that you can see in the night sky and what it is and what constellation it belongs to.
A little bit past our midpoint here. Our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580 is David Levy. He's the science editor of Parade magazine. He is also a contributing editor for Sky and Telescope magazine, writes its monthly Star Trails column. He's authored a number of books about astronomy. He is president of the National Sharing the Sky Foundation. That's an organization that hopes to inspire people to develop an inquiring interest in the sciences. He is one of the most successful comet discoverers ever. He's discovered 22 and maybe is best known as the co-discoverer of the comet Shoemaker-Levy 9, along with Eugene and Carolyn Shoemaker. That, remember, we talked a little bit about that. It was the comet that collided with Jupiter back in 1994. He's here visiting the campus. He'll be talking about Shakespeare as a sky watcher, joining astronomy with English literature. That's this afternoon. No, pardon me, that's tonight, 7:30 in the auditorium of the Beckman Institute. And it is an event in the Millercom series. They're always free and open to the public. Anybody who would like to attend should feel welcome. And if you have questions here this morning about astronomy, you can call in 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Next up is someone in Champaign and line 2. Hello.
Hello, Dr. Levy. I'm really excited about your lecture tonight. I think it's a wonderful idea to combine astronomy with almost any topic.
Thank you.
And I think that the idea of looking at some of the even older traditions of stargazing, like under sort of flaky rubrics of astrology, has a lot of interesting intersections with astronomy. And I wondered if you might comment on that, and I'll take my ticket off the air. I also would like to recommend Chet Ramo's work on kind of bridging that gap between the humanities and the sciences. Thanks.
Right. Yeah, I agree with you. Chet Ramo's a fine author. And I think your question, I want to thank you for your question. It's profound, because what you're looking at, the relationship between astronomy and astrology, is something that you can't easily drop. Today, there isn't a whole lot of reason scientifically to follow what the astrologers tell us. But in the past, especially in Shakespeare's time, most of the astronomy that was done was actually done for predictive purposes. And it wasn't until a telescope was invented 400 years ago next year that the real rift between astronomy and astrology started to form. And I think that rift is here with us to stay. I think the important thing to remember is that there is a relationship between ourselves and the night sky. And that relationship, I don't believe, comes with the signs, whether we're a Gemini or a Virgo or a Capricorn. But it comes so much in the fact that stars are made of hydrogen. And star stuff in the form of hydrogen, helium, oxygen, and nitrogen and carbon forms in small little balls called comets. When comets collided with the Earth when the Earth was young, they brought these elements, the simple alphabet of life, C-H-O-N-N, carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen. They brought these particles to the Earth. And then after a long, long period of time, they developed into amino acids, proteins, RNA, finally DNA, and finally you and me. And so I think there is a relationship between us and the stars, but it lies in that simple alphabet of life that comes from comets. Comets get their material from the stars, especially the stars that have gone supernova, and they deposit that material on the Earth when they collide with the Earth, especially when the Earth was younger, and eventually made you and me. And I think that's a good question. I'm glad you asked it.
All right. Let's talk with someone else. This is someone listening in Urbana. Line one. Hello?
Hello.
Yes.
Would you repeat the title of the book that you mentioned a few minutes ago? I was distracted and didn't get it written down.
Yeah, I'd be happy to repeat it. Thank you. It's called Starlight Nights, The Adventures of a Stargazer. It is written by Leslie C. Peltier, P-E-L-T-I-E-R. And it is available. It is still in print.
P-E-L what?
P-E-L-T-I-E-R, Peltier.
P-E-L-T-I-E-R. Okay.
And
Leslie?
Leslie.
And Starlight Night, and what was the rest of it?
The Adventures of a Stargazer. And I can tell you that it's been in print on and off since 1965. I started reading it. I asked my English teacher if I could read it for a book review I had to do in grade 11 in high school. And she reluctantly said, yeah. And I sat down in bed that night, and I started reading it, and I couldn't put it down. Mm. I was with it right away from cover to cover, and it is by far the best book I have ever read in my life.
So you read it all in one night?
Well, no, but I probably could have if I didn't have to get some sleep at some point. But it's something you could read in a couple of days. And it's definitely worth reading.
Okay, and Starlight Night, The Adventures of a Stargazer by Leslie Peltier.
That's right. You've got it right, 100%.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. This is such an interesting program. I hope you'll come back.
Thank you.
Well,
me too.
Thank you for the call. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. I was interested in having you talk a little bit about connecting with the talk that you're going to give, a little bit about what you can learn about astronomy by reading literature, and particularly going back to things that were written, let us say, before the modern science era.
Well, yeah. David, say you wake up and you want to be an astronomer, and that's what you want to be instead of working for public radio, which I know is one of the highest paying jobs you can get.
Yeah, and actually I'm thinking about a second career now, so yeah, I should be taking notes.
Yeah. But just imagine you're reading a book for light reading. You pick up a book called Ulysses by James Joyce, written around 1920 or so.
I think I heard of that, yeah.
Oh, excuse me. I get so excited about this, I always start to cough. So you're reading the book, and you're near the end of it, and you can't wait to figure out what happens. And you find out that suddenly they're talking about young William Shakespeare, age 8. And he's walking through the summer fields near his home in Stratford at night, looking up at the night sky, and he's seeing this gigantically bright star in a constellation that looks like his own name, W, Cassiopeia. And he looks at this star, and he can't take his eyes off it, and he's just extraordinarily delighted with it. And he decides, well, I'm not going to be an astronomer, because you need math, and I don't have math, nor can I afford a telescope, even though they haven't been invented yet. They had been. I think they had been, but he hadn't heard of them yet. But he's all excited about this star that turns out to be more exciting even than he can imagine. And years later, in like the middle of the 1590s, you look at one of his plays. It was later produced in New York on Broadway as Wars of the Roses. It's actually the first part of Henry VI. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to go very far into it. It's the first line of the play. Hung be the heavens with black, yield day to night. Comets, importing change of times and states, brandish your crystal tresses in the sky. My gosh, I haven't heard of a better way of describing comets ever. If I want a simple sentence to describe comets, I go to Shakespeare. Shakespeare had a sense for the night sky, and right now I'm working on my doctoral thesis relating astronomy to literature. Even though I'm getting to be older, I'm still trying to get educated somehow. And I'm realizing that Shakespeare wrote more about the night sky than all of the other writers of his time put together. I'm finding in almost every play there is at least some reference to the night sky or even to the day sky. But something. The guy was terrific. His view of the sky and his way of merging it both astrologically and astronomically into the action and characterization of his plays is just wonderful. And that's going to be a good part of what I'm going to talk about tonight. It's also going to be a very personal talk. I could tell you, in fact, how I got interested in Hamlet. It was pretty sudden. I was having a big argument with my older brother, Richard. And, you know, what do you do when you get into an older brother argument? How do you solve an older brother argument? There's only one way to do it, especially if you're on the losing end. And that is you grab the nearest book you can and you throw it on the floor. And just at that moment, my dad walks in. And I thought, oh, well, I can't repeat what I thought, but I thought something like that. And Dad very quietly reached down, picked up the book, and gave it to me. It turned out to be Shakespeare's Hamlet. And he said, David, I don't care if you throw a stone at your brother or a pen or something like that, but don't you ever throw a book at him. And I said, why not? And he said, because he said something that at the time I thought was ridiculous, but now I believe it's profound. He said, because books are friends. When you open a book, it is as if the author is inviting you into his or her home. And you are being invited into a early 1600s home to see what life was like back then and how people lived back in Elizabethan and Jacobean England. And I've never forgotten that. I've never forgotten his words about Hamlet. And I've never forgotten the opening lines of Hamlet when the characters are describing the appearance of the ghost. And they talk about that yonder star that's westward from the pole, which was probably the great supernova that Tycho had discovered in 1572, and which the following summer Shakespeare might have been looking at as he walked through the slumberous summer fields late at night.
Wow, that's a great story. Yeah. Do you think that the fact that Shakespeare had all these mentions about astronomy in his plays would have influenced the way people in his time who were seeing the plays when they were new thought about the sky, or maybe were people already thinking about it in that sense then that says that something is going on there and it's important and it may have some influence on what's happening here. So that means we really have to be paying attention to what is going on there.
You couldn't have asked that in a better way, David. Thank you. I'm thinking that especially in King Lear, Shakespeare devotes two pages of that play to describing the roles that eclipses play on human nature. And these late eclipses of the sun and moon portend no good to us, it begins. And it begins a debate about whether eclipses can affect our personalities and our actions, or whether, as his son Edmund says, that this is the excellent foppery of the world, that we lay blame to our problems, the sun, the moon, and the stars. We are guilty by heavenly compulsion. And so he says, no way. We are responsible for our actions, not the sky. But this goes on, and it is actually a very profound debate, and it takes two full pages of what many people consider is Shakespeare's greatest play.
Mm-hmm. See, now that leads to an interesting question about Shakespeare, and I suppose you can ask this question about a lot of things that are in the plays, and that is, where did Shakespeare get this? You would think, was he sitting around the tavern or the coffee house talking with astronomers, or was he reading what people were writing about it at the time? Was he actually doing research in a deliberate way that he took and put into the plays, or was it? It was just something that he soaked up and collected somehow and held on to, and then when the time came, he brought that out.
My guess is that Shakespeare was a voracious reader. He loved reading Holinshed's Chronicles of England and Ireland, and there's a lot about eclipses in Holinshed, and they come at just the right time. I think he lifted a lot of the action of Macbeth out of Holinshed, including almost verbatim the story of the witches, which takes place there. Mm-hmm. And I think that as far as your remark about the taverns, I think that he probably argued voraciously with Ben Jonson, who didn't think he knew the first thing about playwriting, but loved the guy anyway. I think he was able to discuss that with it. And I think he got his ideas from just reading and listening and discussing and keeping an open mind and an open heart and being very enthusiastic about what he was trying to accomplish. I think his main goal was to write about the knights, write about life, to entertain his audiences, because he certainly was very successful at that. But I think he wanted to give them a message as well, many messages. And one of those messages was to learn from what's going on around you. Look around you. Don't just look down at the stones that you're walking on. Look out of the gutter. Look up at the stars as well.
Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, David Levy. He's quite well known as a science writer, an amateur historian. He is the science editor for Parade magazine, contributing editor for Sky and Telescope magazine, and has authored a number of books about astronomy. He's here visiting the campus. We'll give a talk tonight on this very subject that we've been talking about here, that is Shakespeare as a sky watcher. That's tonight, 7:30 at the Beckman Institute. So if you're interested, you could stop by. We have several callers here, and we will try to accommodate as many as we can in the time that remains, which is about 5 minutes, starting with someone in Mahomet on line one. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Yes.
I'm going to ask you to repeat something, some device or something that you were suggesting for that would be simple to help us with the night sky. You said we don't have to buy expensive equipment. We could just get a hold of this. Do you remember?
Am I allowed to use commercial names?
I think it would be fine, yes.
Yeah. Go to Barnes & Noble and get a planisphere. It's a star wheel. Just ask for it.
Oh.
And I think all the Barnes & Nobles have them. And it's a fairly large one. And you can actually use it to put pizza on if you run out of using it to look at the stars.
Okay, and what did you call it again?
A planisphere or a star wheel. If you say star wheel, they should know what you mean.
Great, thank you.
Okay. And this is basically, it's a thing where you can buy by turning it and setting it in a way, so if you all you have to do is figure out what time it is and what day it is, and you can adjust this thing, and then it will show you what you are seeing, and it will tell you what it is.
Yeah.
So it'll tell you what constellations it is and what the major stars in there are.
And you know, it's so easy to find the Big Dipper at this time of year. It's hanging almost overhead, and It's so nice to look at it, and from there, you arc to Arcturus, and you speed along to Spica, and the planisphere makes it so easy to do that, and it hardly costs anything, and it's well worthwhile, and as long as you don't drive over it or step on it, it'll last you forever.
Okay. And we go to Urbana. This is line number two. Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
What was the Shakespeare's play that you said had this opening paragraph about the stars?
Hung Be the Heavens with Black Eel Day Tonight comes from 1 Henry VI. Henry VI, Part 1. It's
Henry VI, Part 1.
And it's also the opening lines to Wars of the Roses.
Oh, okay.
Which was the Broadway thing that was done based on those plays, all three of those plays.
Okay, thank you.
Uh-huh. Thanks.
Thank you. And to Champagne, then. Line number three. Hello.
Hi. I have two questions. One, I'm not able to be out in the night sky. If there's a good website that would at least give one some view of the night sky. Two, when working with small children, I am Catholic, and I'm not a fundamentalist, but how does one introduce the idea of the alphabet coming from the comets and being the beginning of life with the 6 days of creation without being hypocritical or condescending to what the Bible has to say, not in a literal interpretation, but that God created life in 6 days.
You've just said the magic words.
I would appreciate it.
Yeah. I think the magic words come in the idea that astronomy was not written for professional astronomers to study in universities, just as music was not written for musicians. And Shakespeare did not write his play for critics to go over it for 400 years. It was all done for the rest of us. Astronomy was written so that people could go out and become passionate about the night sky. Not just to say astronomy is a hobby, but to say, I am passionate about going out and just learning the sky. You don't need to go out in the cold. You can do it from your darkened window and from your living room and see some of the bright stars in the sky. And you can watch the moon without even going out of doors. It's an exciting thing to do. It's a beautiful thing to do. And the fact is, there are a lot of open questions as to how the stars got there. But what is not an open question is that they are there, and that the night sky is there to be appreciated and enjoyed by everybody. And I would recommend that as strongly as I possibly can, to go out and enjoy the night sky.
Mm. And there's lots and lots of information about astronomy on the web. If you have internet access, there are a jillion websites about astronomy. The magazines, Sky and Telescope and Astronomy, they have online editions. There are just countless places where there's information about astronomy. All you got to do is put that into your browser and you'll get enough hits to keep you busy for a long time.
Yeah, if you go to a website, you could Google this, clear dark sky. It'll give you the weather forecast for your area if you just type in where you are or go to the nearest one. And it presents it as a chart, and it gives you every hour whether the sky is expected to be clear or cloudy in that particular hour. That's one of the many websites. Also, Sky and Telescope, one word, skyandtelescope.com. You can go to our own website, which is sharingthesky.org. Our goal is very simple. It's not to teach. There are a lot of people that do that very well. But it is to inspire. That's the tough part. Once you are inspired, the teaching comes easy. You can do it yourself. The difficult thing is to get inspired. That's what Sharing the Sky tries to do. www.sharingthesky.org.
So
I'd recommend.
Why? Obviously, you are very passionate about this. I mean, not only are you passionate about the subject, but you're passionate about trying to encourage other people to get passionate about the subject. Why does this matter so much to you?
It matters because there's so much more to life than reading the evening news or watching the latest disaster on television. I think the best commercial I've ever seen in my life comes out of an old issue of Sky and Telescope from back in the late 60s or early 60s. And it shows an empty chair and a TV that's off. And it said, Johnny isn't watching The Late Show tonight. And then below it, they show a picture of him with his telescope outside looking at the night sky. I think that's so terrific.
And does that, I mean, for you, does that, when you look at the night sky, as you have so many times, I'm sure, throughout your life, I mean, does this get you in a cosmic frame of mind? I mean, not just in the literal sense of thinking about those kinds of questions?
Yes, it does, and I carry it with me throughout my daily life and daily interests. For example, I believe if you want to run for president of the United States, you should have discovered at least two comets. Senator or representative, just one comet would do. But for president, you should have found at least two.
That would trim down the field a little bit.
Just a bit.
Well, our guest this morning, David Levy, is the science editor for Parade magazine. He contributes to Sky and Telescope. He's the author of a number of books about astronomy. And he will be giving a talk on the subject Shakespeare as a Sky Watcher, Joining Astronomy with English Literature. This is an event in the MillerCom series. These are always free and always open to the public, sponsored by a number of units on the campus. Number one here, I guess we'd have to say, at least in terms of the alphabet, would be the Department of Astronomy. We want to give a heads up to them, and also a number of others. And he'll be talking on this subject at the auditorium of the Beckman Institute. That's on North Matthews in Urbana. That's tonight at 7:30. And anyone who would like to attend is certainly welcome to stop by. And of course, if you're interested in books on astronomy, you can go out to the bookstore and look for some of his, and you can also get your planisphere there, and you'll be all ready to go.
David, you are an excellent interviewer.
Oh, you are much too kind. Thank you very much, David Levy. Our program here, Focus 580, is made possible in part with support from the Infant Parent Institute, celebrating its 20th anniversary in Champaign. The Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information available on the web at infantparent.com. Programming also made possible by a grant from the Thrifty Nichols American Classifieds, distributed each Thursday in over 100 towns in East Central Illinois, on the web at AmericanClassifieds.com. Coming up in the next part of the show, we'll be talking with Richard Florida, a man who's become well known for writing about cities and what makes them vital, exciting places to be. His most recent book is Who's Your City? How the Creative Economy is Making Where to Live the Most Important Decision of Your Life. More on that in the next hour. First, though, we'll break for an update on the markets and news, so please stay tuned.
It's 10:58. I'm Tom Rogers with this market update. The commodity markets, particularly the corn and the soybeans, trading near the limit up levels, if not there. All the nearby contracts in corn and beans are trading up the limit, as well as the rest of the soy complex. Wheat, not so much, but still very healthy gains today. The fund starting to buy after the sell-off from last week. The May wheat contract in Kansas City is at 11.20 and a half a bushel right now, up 52 cents. July up 42 at 11.10. In Chicago, May wheat is at 10.72 and a half, up 52 and a half cents. The July at 10.70 and three quarters, up 52 and a quarter cents. In the corn pit, limit up on the May, July, September, and December contracts. The May right now at 544 and three quarters, July 557, September 560 a bushel, Dease corn 559 and three quarters, and December of 09 trading at 532, up 13 cents. May beans right now at 1307, up the 50-cent limit, as are July and August. The July right now at 1322, August at 1316, November of 08 beans trading up 47.5 cents right now at 1236.5. The products are also up the limit. Soybean meal for May up 20 at 350.30, and the July at 354.50, up 20. May soybean oil up 2 even at 57.77, July at 58.62, up 2 as well. On the Mercantile Exchange,